All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
Every day we are bombarded by so many messages that speak about what self-care looks like and what it is, from telling us to exercise more, to eat healthier, to take more walks, right? And part of what's left out of this conversation is that our very first understandings of self-care began in the places where we grew up. So today we are going to talk about what does it mean to grow up? And we're talking about a first-gen household where you may have one immigrant parent or two immigrant parents, and how that influence our own understanding of what well-being is as we understand it and our relationship to wellness. So today I have my dearest friend Hazel, who talks about the work that she does in the Southeast Asian community and how this work is directly related to her understanding of redefining her own well-being.
In the South Asian culture, where there is that concept of, you know, self-care somehow loosely, but it's kind of frowned upon. It's kind of looked down upon. It's something you do in secret and don't tell other people about it.
On the season of The Labyrinth of the First Gen, we will explore a conversation about what we carry with us and what we redefine. We are pioneers just by simply existing.
My name is Hazel, and I've recently started embracing my middle name, so that's Hina. At the moment, I'm living in Vancouver, Canada, and I work at a nonprofit organization, and we mostly work in supporting immigrant, refugee, and visible minority families in BC. So in particular, women and children who are currently dealing with family violence or would like some support in leaving an abusive relationship. I have a background in education. I taught English as a second language in Bogota, Colombia for around 6 years. Also have a background in instructional designing, curriculum development. And I also want to just add that I'm a lifelong learner. So who knows what are going to be the new things that come into play, and I'll be going back to school in the fall.
How do you define your race and or ethnicity and the places that you are from?
If I have to talk about my race or ethnicity, I was born and brought up in India, so I do consider myself as South Asian. And then the cultural component, I would say it's a combination of three places. So I was born and raised my earlier years in India, but then we did move to Canada, and that played a huge part in my understanding of culture.
In the United States, children of immigrants represent 1 in 4 in the country. And for Canada, children under the age of 15 years with an immigrant background, meaning that they have parents from somewhere else, maybe one parent or both parents, number is nearly at 2.2 million and can well represent over 49% of the total population of children by the year 2036.
I do consider myself as an Indian Canadian. But then, as I mentioned earlier, I did move to Colombia and I was living there for 6 years. Along with that, my husband is also Colombian. So that has also, you know, kind of played into the mix. So if I have to say culturally, I consider myself from those three places, and I've taken components from all three and made them my own.
This discussion was talking about our cultural upbringing and how that has been an influence in our understanding of what well-being is and what it means to us. Cynthia Ung, who is a first generation medical student, gave a talk about expanding this idea of self-care to our relationship to love. She talked about how upbringing was significant in her own journey and understanding her relationship to love. So I wanted to ask Hazel, what were her thoughts that our cultural upbringing and it having an influence on our relationship to self-care and relationship to love, self-love? This is what she responded.
In Hindi, we have this word, it's called seva. And seva is basically service. So our religion, our culture, it's really entrenched in the concept of serving. I think for women, especially, we were raised to serve others at that personal cost. And that personal cost, well, it's one of those things where you either suppress it or you forget about it. And the reason you do those two things is because you're constantly worried about, well, what will other people say?
In a Canadian study on neighborhood and family of immigrant children's mental health, it was found that immigrant children exhibit a prevalence of psychological distress that are even nearly double than that of their parents. Much of this is due to the experiences of children of immigrants having the financial, cultural, and emotional caregiving responsibilities that they assume for their parents, which affects their well-being.
So, you know, if you're angry or if you're frustrated, to just show those emotions, that's such a negative thing for women to be able to openly show with others. And I think for the longest time, again, like getting personal for a bit, I really believed my purpose was to keep everyone around me happy. And of course, I'm still working through that. And I think it takes a long time to unlearn something like that and also to like catch that as it's happening.
Something that is coming up is this idea of suppressing feelings and emotions. Are there any examples of how this came up for you, particularly with your household or in the environment where you grew up?
A few stories come to mind for me when I think of the way I was raised. For example, my mom many times would say, okay, like if we're having people over, whatever you have going on, drop that, pause that, be there with the relatives or whoever. Make sure that the tea is served, make sure the snacks are out. So it was like, if there's anything wrong or if there's anything that you're doing in the moment, it's not as important as showing others that everything is okay, showing others that they're welcome. Like the message that kind of I learned from when I was a kid was, okay, whatever my needs are, whatever I want, I need to pause that and I need to put everyone else's needs above me and welcome them.
We talked about what does it mean to grow up as a first gen, and this idea of our parents having their own means of defining their own mental, physical well-being within their own communities. But this also looks very different from how we define it on our own today.
But I have to say that, like, you know, even the previous generations, they did have a way of coping. You know, for example, I think of my mom, who used to tell me that when she was younger, a part of her daily routine was to go to the town well to get water for the day. And it was a long walk, it was under the sun, but it would give her time to just like think, process. It was just her me time. And then she would come back, and once she's back, you know, she's doing her chores and her tasks again. But that was like her me time. So yeah, like there were these little, we would call it self-care now. I think the previous generations also had things like that.
I know that something that comes up for me is this individualistic Western cultures, and that's very different from our parents, right? Where they were surrounded by community and they depended on the community in terms of their well-being, from like providing for them to their relationships, right? So I think it's a good point to bring up that cultural difference, and even now, you know, how that shows up even within my own culture. So I want to talk a little bit about those differences. So does collective identity, especially speaking to the Southeast Asian culture, show up when we're talking about well-being, and in what ways?
Married women, and again, I'm talking about back in the day, especially in smaller villages where, you know, their husbands have gone to work, they have a short amount of time to kind of prepare for the lunch or the dinner. And so then you would have like these moments where these women in the village, they would just kind of come together, and, you know, maybe they'll be cutting vegetables together and talking to each other. And I think that was therapeutic in many ways, because you are able to get your frustration out. But at the same time, there's only so far that those conversations are going to take you.
Something that resonated with me was a conversation around the role of religion in immigrant communities. We're talking about mental health, how religion often becomes a space that people turn to in times of need.
For South Asians, religion also plays a huge part. And a lot of the women that I support, they really talk about the power of prayer. There's a few people that really come to mind for me, but there's one person in particular where she told me that all of her strength, all of the things that she has been through, the strength was because of her faith. It was because of her religion. And she says, you know, every day without fail, I pray. I pray and I ask the universe for guidance. I ask the universe for that strength. And she says, all of the people that, you know, come into my life and that have helped me, I've asked for them. When I met her, she was just such a like a strong, badass woman. I'm sorry, I don't know if I can say badass, but yeah. And she was saying that all of her strength she gets from religion. And I think that's beautiful. I think it's really whatever works for us. I personally am not a very religious person, but I can respect that. I can see how having that faith is something that is consistent. It is something that grounds a person, and it really helps with the emotional regulation. There's so many benefits to having that faith or to having that one thing in your life that you believe in.
Thinking about the communal context and how people just depend on each other, can we think about in what ways this to show up in your community as something that is positive?
I think something positive that comes out of it is just providing space for other people and just kind of making sure that they're welcomed, you know, being there for someone, caring for them. I think those are all positive qualities. Lending out that, like, you know, helping hand if someone else is in trouble. So I think that was kind of the intention behind all of that. So I think, yes, there are healing properties in having those conversations with your community. and in, you know, just getting your day-to-day frustrations out.
There's so much beauty in relying in our communities for our physical, emotional, well-being. But as Hazel mentioned, there are also implications and some things that also come up for us when we are trying to define our own path, different from our cultural understandings of what we learned in our upbringing.
So it was only like a few years ago that I decided, you know what, this is not working. Every time I reached out to my parents or my family, you're still told that same narrative and that same script. So deep down, you feel like, no, there has to be something more out there. So I think it was in that moment where I really just, I was like, okay, I need a therapist. You know, I need a professional. I need an outsider to kind of come in and give me some insight to what's going on. Because if I look around me or if I ask my own community for help, well, they're just telling me, well, no, you're wrong. This is how it's always been. And I'm fine. So you also need to be fine. So yeah, I think at least for my upbringing, and I see a lot of that in my culture, in the South Asian culture, where there is that concept of, you know, self-care somehow loosely, but it's kind of frowned upon. It's kind of looked down upon. It's something you do in secret and don't tell other people about it.
What is something negative that comes out of our parents depending on solely on their communities for their emotional as well as physical well-being?
Something negative that comes out of it, of course, is many times that gets misinterpreted and we think, okay, my needs are not important or I am not as important. So awareness is one bit, but just to catch yourself when you're doing that, it's so ingrained that it's definitely going to take a while. But I think I reached a moment in my own personal journey where I was like, wait, hold up, this is not working. If I continue to suppress my feelings, if I continue to kind of, this happened and I was not happy with that, I was not okay with that, but I have to keep it in.
In Cynthia's TED Talk, she talks about this idea of authenticity that Hazel also brings up and how that might look like defining self-love for ourselves, and that can be completely different from our upbringing. We're going to take a quick pause, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about Hazel's work and her journey to redefining what her own mental health and well-being means to her. Labyrinth of the First Gen is a podcast about the first gen experience. Here's how the others have defined what being first gen means to them.
Really, trailblazers in the sense that we are the first. We are the pioneers. We are the first ones doing whatever it is that we're doing, wherever we're doing it.
The episode's Labyrinth of the First Gen will be released every Tuesday. And we also want to hear from you if you would love to share your stories on labyrinthofthefirstgen@gmail.com. We are looking forward to being a part of your journey. And we are back. This is the Labyrinth of the First Gen. Hazel talked about the impact of only and solely depending on your community for your emotional well-being and how this shows up in her day-to-day work that she does with Southeast Asian women.
I think, again, going back to my work, a lot of these women, when they finally decide to reach out for help, and it's not just the work I do, I think it's all of us, that moment where we're like, okay, you know what? I really need help. This is not working. I think at that point, we have spoken to people from our community. We have spoken to our moms, our grandmothers, our dad, whoever it is, our friends. That hasn't been helpful. So we've had to just kind of be like, you know what? Who can I go to outside the community? Who's going to give me a different perspective? Again, I'm talking about my own journey, but I think a lot of the women that I have worked with, they reach that point. They have exhausted all the possible resources within their community. And now it's time to kind of look elsewhere. And what I have seen is also the other side, where there is that resilience that gets built, where there is that knowledge and that perspective that becomes wider and more diverse and more empathetic towards what else is out there. And that has really played a part in their journey.
Do you think the experience of immigrating to other countries outside of their cultures is what exposed these women to other options and other possibilities of seeking help elsewhere?
One thing, for example, is with immigrant families, a lot of what we have seen and grown up with is from our own country. And then when we move to a country like the United States or Canada, where there's so much diversity, we really struggle with like, well, what's right and what's wrong here? And I think that it's in that moment where we really need that outlook, where we really need that like, oh, you know what? There's something beyond the way I was raised or beyond what my reality was. And I think that's also like a big part in like the cultural shock that we go through when we move to a new country. So if only in that moment we have that support or that outlook or that perspective of there's more things out there and I just need to be curious and learn, that would be a game changer for anyone.
A huge part of this conversation was talking about not only cultural nuances to understandings of well-being, but also generational differences and how that shows up.
I think we're really the first generation where we're just like, you know what? Our mental well-being comes first before anything else. And I think it also, like, the reason that's happened is because we saw the way our parents and our grandparents raised us. And, you know, they were taught to put everyone else's needs above their own. And so when they were raising us, I think inherently, like, it just kind of clicked for us, like, wait, you know, this doesn't work. This isn't working. So I really think that has forced us to just kind of look for what's authentic to ourselves.
In her work of social service, she talks about the importance of seeking an external person, someone that is outside of our communities, and how this can be particularly helpful when we are looking for resources.
Of like new perspectives and in terms of new way of looking at things, we do need that external person to kind of come in and offer it to us, because sometimes we've grown up around something. It's difficult to go out there and find it for yourself.
It is understandable that something new can be frightening and also scary, and we can't also not acknowledge the experiences that parents as well as children of immigrants have every day around racism, classism, all of those things when they enter medical offices or medical facilities, and how that impacts their understanding and their relationship to seeking services. And on a cultural level, I can resonate with sharing with my parents that I have access to therapy resources. The idea of having a therapist or getting those resources can also seem strange to immigrant communities or even children of immigrants who have not been exposed to that before. Have you brought up to your parents that you have, that you are currently in therapy, and how did they receive that if you did?
Well, I have to say that I have not had that conversation with my own parents or my own family. So they do not know that I you know, seeked this assistance.
But Hazel did talk about what the different responses and reactions are to suggestions around therapy or counseling the women that she works with.
I predominantly work with South Asian women. So I have noticed that with the older generation, self-care is, it's like, you know, if you even suggest therapy or counseling for, you know, such challenging things that these women have been through, they perceive it as, there's a lot of misinformation around counseling and therapy.
According to a study on immigrant-based disparities in mental health care utilization, many immigrant communities lack information about their options for formal and affordable mental health care. And often this also affects children of immigrants that may hold the same or similar misconceptions about receiving mental health care services or face stigma for needing support, and also struggling to comprehend fully the availability and or the access to resources.
So they kind of receive it as, well, there's nothing wrong with my brain. Like, what are you trying to say? So it's seen as this big negative, like, you know, a mental illness type of a concept. So there's a lot of misinformation around therapy. There's a lot of misunderstanding, and it's kind of also almost seen as an insult to even suggest therapy or counseling. I think a lot of the fear is also that, oh, this doctor, like, what is this doctor going to do? Or, like, you know, they're going to, again, like, this is like back in the day, I remember there was this thing of like, oh, if I go to therapy, there, it's some sort of like, they do stuff, they make you doubt things, they make you, and it's, that's not the case, right? So I really do think, yeah, the more conversations we have around it, the more we share our experiences with therapy, it will build more knowledge around what it is as a concept and how it could help us.
For people that have never had therapy before or have heard of a counselor, it can be really intimidating and people can be really fearful. And it doesn't help that the media also feeds into the misconceptions and the assumptions around how therapy works and what it is.
I do know, for example, the media doesn't help. So a lot of, again, I'm going back to, like, you know, certain discussions that I've had with some women recently, where, for example, they're just like, okay, so I've seen in a movie that you go to a therapist and then after one or two sessions, everything is fine. Everything is good. You feel happy again. So there is also that thing of, okay, I've seen this in the movies. Now I'm going to a therapy session, but I'm not feeling happy after the first two sessions. What's wrong? So there is this thing of like, wait, I have to do my own work. I have to do my own digging. I have to sit in it. With the younger generations, I have noticed that there is, and these are, for example, women that have just moved from India. So, you know, like they've been in Canada, but for a very short amount of time. So the majority of, you know, their upbringing, everything has been from India. They're a little bit open to it, but they're also a little bit curious, like, okay, so what is it? What should I expect when I go to see a therapist? How is it going to help me? What do they do? So there is that fear, but there is a little bit of that curiosity, because I think with our generation, there's a little bit more exposure to counseling, to mental health.
And so how do we bridge this gap? How do we navigate cultural nuances and general differences?
I think a lot of the work that needs to be done is just to have those conversations about what it is and what therapy is, what does it look like, and what are the benefits of it. And yes, the benefits of it, they're not going to happen overnight. It's going to take time. But if you sit with it, you know, maybe what could happen is you somehow, you know, like, it's not going to disappear. Healing is not that my trauma has disappeared, but it is that somehow I have adapted and I have learned to live with it and I've made my peace with it. It's always going to be a part of me. So I just think that if we have those conversations around what it is and what are the benefits of it, yeah, that needs to happen.
To wrap up, I wanted to ask, what is one thing from your upbringing or your childhood that you still do carry with you around this topic of wellness, well-being, physical as well as emotional health?
So one thing that I've recently, and by recent I mean in the past 2 years, have taken on is meditation. And then again, like, that's something that my dad, you know, when I was younger, when I was a kid, he would be like, meditate, meditate. But I think I took it on and made it my own. So that's definitely one thing that's really helped me. And, you know, like, even in terms of religion, meditation is a big part of our spiritual and like religious upbringing. At least in my household, it's always been. So I've definitely continued with that. I've also continued with, I don't want to say I have continued with it completely, but the concept of prayer, I've made it my own. So when I was little, we would pray, like, you know, we would have like the little statues of gods and goddesses, and you would pray in the morning and in the evening. And it was always like, it needs to happen every single day, twice a day. It felt like a chore to me. But I liked the concept of, you know, taking those few minutes to just kind of reach out to the universe and show your gratitude. And if there is something that you want to ask for, take those few minutes to ask for it. And then one thing is, you know, you would take the light, the diya, and we would walk around the whole house. And so the idea is, with that light, you're cleansing and you're purifying your entire living space. So I've taken that. I've really loved it. So what I normally do is, instead of the diya, I just take incense sticks and I walk around the whole house. I have that intention of, like, you know, practicing gratitude. If there's something that, like, you know, I really want to ask, normally it's for the health and well-being of my friends and family. So I've taken those things, made it my own, and I practice it. And I think that keeps me grounded. It makes me feel safe, and it works for me.
This episode of The Labyrinth of the First Gem was produced by me. I would like to say, Sedeme, thank you, Hazel, for coming in, just sharing your personal as well as professional experience with us. As always, be in peace, folks, and see you later.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.